Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Courtroom Confidential, a weekly series covering headline-making criminal cases from across the country. I am your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a former Los Angeles District Attorney and now a criminal defense attorney, bringing you what I hope are unique insights from both sides of the courtroom. On a personal note, we are touched, we are encouraged by the support and positive feedback that we have already received in the early beginnings of the show. If you haven't already, please subscribe, like the show, leave a comment, tell a friend. We appreciate so much all that you do. All right, let's jump right in. First, we have breaking news out of Connecticut. Just moments ago, Michelle Tracones, who was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, tampering with evidence, and hindering a prosecution, has been found guilty on all counts for the 2019 murder and disappearance of wealthy Connecticut socialite Jennifer Doulos. Prosecutors had alleged that Fotos Doulos, Tracones' boyfriend at the time, had carried out the murder, with Tracones aiding in the cover-up of the crime. The jury had deliberated for 2 full days. After the verdict was read, Tracones laid her head down on the defense table and wept. Tracones, age 49, is set to be sentenced on May 31st. She faces up to 20 years in prison, or possibly even more if the judge decides to run the sentence concurrently. We will, of course, keep you updated on all developments. 26-year-old Venezuelan citizen Jose Ibarra was arrested last week in connection with the brutal murder of nursing student Lincoln Riley. The 22-year-old was killed in broad daylight while out on a morning jog along a popular UGA running trail. Authorities have not said exactly how she was killed, but Ibarra is accused of dragging Riley to a secluded location and using an unknown object as a weapon, which is described in the affidavit as, quote unquote, disfiguring her skull. Immigration authorities say Ibarra unlawfully crossed into the U.S. in 2022, which has sparked outrage and questions regarding whether stronger immigration policies could have prevented this death. All right, well, what's going on here? According to the affidavit for arrest, we can learn some very interesting and also highly disturbing facts. First of all, the prosecution has already presented 2 theories on first-degree murder. First is they've accused him of murder with malice aforethought. That is straightforward first-degree murder, premeditated murder. But the other is that they've charged him with a theory of felony murder. In other words, a murder that occurred during the course of a felony can also be charged as a first-degree murder. This is important for sentencing. This is important for exposure for possibly the death penalty, if that's applicable in that jurisdiction. But it also begs the question of what is the underlying felony? Well, they've already charged him in this same affidavit. It's not a charging document, but it's an affidavit which includes their allegations for arrest with kidnapping, because they believe that he moved her at one point to a secluded location. But it also begs the question of, were perhaps other felonies involved? And though we don't see any evidence thus far of any kind of sexual assault or attempts at rape, it really makes you begin to wonder what were the motivations behind all of this and the murder itself, and will that play a role moving forward? Also, they have charged him with physically preventing her from calling 911, which is interesting to me because it's one, a separate allegation. It's a separate crime to prevent someone essentially from dissuading them from going to the police or authorities. But it also makes you wonder, what evidence do they have of that? Was her phone located nearby? Is there evidence that she tried to make a phone call? Did she actually make a phone call? And did he stop her in the course of making that 911 call? All interesting evidence that can be gleaned from even a small amount of information that we have at this time. And finally, there is talk about dragging her to a secluded area. And this one proves the kidnapping charge. But it also tells us that perhaps there was planning that went into this crime rather than it simply being a crime of opportunity. And why do I say that? Because it lends to the idea that the perpetrator knew there was a secluded area nearby, knew perhaps that attacking her where he had attacked her, remember, this was in broad daylight, would be in an area that they would not be seen, that he could move her to another location and either commit further crimes or commit her murder there. Which also asked the question, did he know her pattern? Had he watched her before? Did he know that she would be jogging in this area? Did he know the area? Did he bring a weapon with him? All of this to me, and I realize we're going off of very small information here, and I'm doing my best to read the tea leaves, but all of this to me spells out that this was a planned crime and not a crime of what we might call opportunity, where someone just in the spur of the moment decides to commit a crime. End of the day, it's horrible. It's awful. It's a nightmare for her family, for that entire community to live through. And we will, of course, continue to watch this closely and monitor it and keep you updated as updates occur. Moving on, behind-the-scenes clips taken during the filming of Alec Baldwin's Western movie Rust were shown for the first time during armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed's involuntary manslaughter trial this week. If you haven't been following this case closely, which is surprising because it seems like it's all over the news, Gutierrez-Reed is facing involuntary manslaughter and tampering charges for inadvertently loading a fully functioning 45 caliber revolver with dummy rounds and at least one live round, then providing the gun to Baldwin during a rehearsal in October of 2021, where he fatally shot cinematographer Helena Hutchins. The jury saw a video of Baldwin using a gun as a pointing stick and essentially directing people with the use of the gun, and rushing Gutierrez-Reed to reload the weapon for a second take. We have some footage that was shown inside the courtroom that we can show to you now.
Set, set, ready, and action. One more. I forgot the recoil stuff. No, right away. Let's reload.
Here we go. So, Helena. Hi.
Here we go. Come on.
Well, I had to go closer because Danny did, so. You want
to go rolling. Okay, copy.
We should add two guns and both were reloading. Well, let me show you something. Hold on. Step back to your original mark. So one thousand, two, I'm getting up.
Right.
Then when he drops his arm, Helena, get out. He drops his arm. That means Brady's close.
As you can see, what's most disturbing about the video is the kind of casual, cavalier use that he has for the weapon. This is a loaded weapon, regardless of what he feels are the rounds inside of it, and regardless whether or not he feels it is safe. You were always taught to consider a weapon to be dangerous at all times. And certainly the manner in which he's using it, like I said, casually, cavalier, using it to direct others on the set. It also highlights how involved he is in the filmmaking process as far as directing others and rushing others to get another take done. Veteran armorer Brian Carpenter, the state's expert witness, said that multiple safety procedures were passed over in the clip. The expert added that though Gutierrez-Reed was new in the business, she took the position and those on set depended on her guidance and her professionalism to keep anyone from being harmed. And convenience isn't an option at that point. That is a quote directly from his testimony. All right. Well, what's going on here? I feel like in these first few witnesses, while not devastating to the prosecution, there have been surprising twists where they've become helpful to the defense. Remember, much of the defense here depends on showing that the Rust set was essentially a mess and that safety standards were being ignored and corners were being cut across the board, top to bottom, not just Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, as that much of the safety shortcomings were outside of her control. This video that we just saw, I think, is a crucial point in moving the needle forward on those exact arguments. She can show through that video that she's not the one calling the shots as far as safety goes. She's taking orders from Alec Baldwin, who, by the way, is not just the star of the movie, but is her boss as a producer. He's saying, let's hurry up. Let's get another take going. He's handling the gun casually. Reload it. Hand it back to me. Again, the more that she can show that things were outside of her control, the better, I think, for her case. And also, while the defense weapons expert and the assistant director David Hall said that Gutierrez Reed could have been better in her job. Neither of them were willing to go as far as to say that she was grossly negligent in her conduct. And that is the entire point. You remember, Halls is the person who took a plea deal early on in this whole case. He was charged initially, too, and took a plea deal. And we thought he was going to be the star witness on behalf of the prosecution. And I got to say, I'm a little surprised. I thought his testimony would be far more revealing and far more indicting of Gutierrez Reed. And while he did testify that Gutierrez Reed handed the weapon directly to Baldwin. Remember, there was evidence that perhaps she handed it to Halls and Halls handed it to Baldwin. He said now in his testimony that, in fact, he gave it back to her or never took possession of it and that she handed it directly to Baldwin. He also admitted that he himself did an improper check of that firearm. That, again, is a quote from his testimony. This all plays into her defense that everyone on set, top to bottom, were lacking in their attention to the on-set safety. It's far from over. A lot yet to come in this trial. As in all trials, there are twists and turns and good days for the prosecution and bad days for the prosecution. And I guess that's all to say this is far from over. But so far, I am a little surprised by some of the developments and how they seem to be going in Gutierrez Reed's favor. We will continue to watch. Trial continues. All right, moving on. An Illinois judge who overturned the conviction of a man accused of sexual assault was removed from the bench last Friday in a 33-page ruling by the state's courts commission. Former Adams County Judge Robert Adrian sparked outrage in 2022 when he vacated the 18-year-old Drew Clinton sexual assault conviction. After a three-day bench trial in 2021, Adrian originally found Clinton guilty of one count of criminal sexual assault, which carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 4 years in prison. In 2022, Adrian let Clinton walk free, saying the defendant's nearly 5 months in county jail was, quote, plenty of punishment. The courts commission wrote that Adrian, quote, intentionally subverted the law and then lied about it under oath to serve his own interests. They went on to add that we have already concluded that the respondent, meaning the judge, reversed his guilty finding to circumvent the law. Very strong wording there. 18-year-old Cameron Vaughn, the woman at the center of the case, says that the 2022 decision left her broken. And even though the system didn't produce her desired result at trial, she considers Adrian's dismissal another form of justice. We should say that Vaughn has chosen to make her own identity public. All right, what's going on here? Well, first, it's important to understand that a fundamental idea that undergirds our criminal justice system is that judges will not substitute their own ideas or feelings for the actual law. This judge clearly did that, even by his own admission. A judge's job, regardless if he felt that the law was too draconian or that it didn't actually reflect the gravity of the crime, that's not his choice to make. The other thing to understand and why it makes the first point more important is that this was a bench trial, meaning there was no jury. He was acting both as judge and jury. That's important because he's the one deciding guilt. He's the one deciding the facts, all the while knowing what the punishment will be. So his decision is simply, do the facts match the element of the crime? And if so, find that person guilty. And if so, the law says they should be sentenced as such. And he decided, and I think this is by his own admission, that those laws are far too severe. And realizing that after coming to his verdict, I'm going to go ahead and change what the verdict was to avoid the consequences as determined by the law. This is simply not how it works. For him to turn around and later say that the evidence was now insufficient when absolutely nothing changed in the interim is completely unacceptable and calls again into question one of the foundations of our criminal justice system. That being, verdicts are final. We have to believe that. We have to believe that when a jury or a judge comes to a verdict, that's the end of it. If we start playing this game of going back and changing our minds and not realizing the consequences were not what they would expect it to be, we're left in a very slippery slope of consequences that may be very unintended and dire. In many jurisdictions, the decision or even what the exposure is for the defendant, meaning what they're looking at as far as prison, is never told to the jurors because they're supposed to be making a decision independent from that. They're supposed to be making a decision based entirely on the facts and how those apply to the law and not what they feel like is justice as far as punishment, that's a decision to be decided by the judge and in sometimes decided by legislators and the law when they say that some things have mandatory minimums. We could get into a whole discussion later about whether or not mandatory minimums are a good idea, but that was what was applicable in this case. The judge has gone on record as describing what the problems of proof were in the case, which is all fine and good. But if that is true, he should have arrived at a different verdict to begin with. He later on essentially tried to run it back and say, you know what? Now taking a second look in light of, I don't know, having slept on it, I believe that the evidence did not qualify for the crime. To me, again, that seems unacceptable and it seems to be hiding what in fact his true motivations were, that he did not feel the punishment fit the crime, but that wasn't the decision that he was making at that time. All right. Also making headlines this week, a Los Angeles jury found wealthy socialite Rebecca Grossman guilty of 2 counts of murder, 2 counts of gross vehicular manslaughter, and 1 count of hit and run in the 2020 deaths of Mark and Jacob Iskander, ages 11 and 8. This was a tragic, horrible nightmare of a story to begin with. She has now been convicted. She faces 34 years to life in prison and is scheduled to return to court April 10th for sentencing. We will follow that. And finally, a Brooklyn federal jury found Carl Jordan Jr. and Ronald Washington guilty of killing pioneering DJ Jam Master Jay in 2002 over what prosecutors characterize as a revenge for a failed drug deal. Jordan was his godson, while Washington was an old friend. Very sad story and a loss for everyone. Finally, on the docket for next week, jury selection in the trial for James Crumbly, the father of the Michigan school shooter Ethan Crumbly, is set to begin on Tuesday, March 5th. Prosecutors are seeking to prove that James, like his wife, Jennifer Crumbly, caused his son's actions through gross negligence or by willfully disregarding the threat that his son posed to others by failing to act on signs that he may be dangerous. Again, a groundbreaking case that we will continue to follow and update you all. Once again, I am your host, Joshua Ritter. You can find me on all social media platforms at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. And thank you again for joining me. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and share your thoughts on these cases in the comments. And feel free to suggest cases that you would like me to discuss in the future. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. And thank you again for joining us for another episode of Courtroom Confidential.